It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kemp. We're in conversation with a New York Times reporter about takeaways from covering the pandemic in a recent investigation into poor air quality in school buildings. COVID-19 put a spotlight on proper ventilation. Be part of the discussion at any point, calling in with a question. Share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Apoorva Mondavilli is a science and global health reporter for the New York Times and an alumna of UW-Madison. Apoorva, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you're set to give a seminar at your alma mater about your experience reporting in the pandemic, and it is being given to biochemistry students. What do you hope students gather from your experience as a global health reporter?
You know, I tried to think about what they might want to hear just because I was a biochemistry graduate student back in the day, which is partly why they invited me. And so I'm trying to think about what I didn't know then and what I would have wanted to know. So two things, really. One is that there are career options that will still make use of your science education, your science interest, that don't have to do with just research. That's something that I didn't know initially in grad school, and it took me a while to figure out that science journalism was even a thing. So I want to talk to them about the other sort of career options that they might have that will still make use of biochemistry. And then the other thing is I want them to have a better understanding of how science journalism works. I think a lot of scientists don't fully understand what goes into a news article. You know, I often get scientists telling me that they want to collaborate with me or that we're in this together. And that's really not the case. You know, science journalists hold scientists accountable, just like politics journalists hold politicians accountable. And so I think they would benefit from a clearer understanding of this divide between science and journalism.
I think science journalists have had a really particularly important role around helping people understand COVID vaccines, you know, then and now, I guess, with boosters. How do you approach that type of writing about the vaccines, and how do you dispel misinformation?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to remember is that everybody is just looking for information that helps them make decisions about how to protect themselves and how to protect their loved ones. All of the sort of esoteric knowledge comes a little bit later. So when I'm writing, I'm trying to think about what does the average person really want and need to know about these vaccines? You know, there might be cool sciencey things that appeal to me as a science writer, but what does the reader need to know about this? And so I try to keep it very simple, very straightforward. You know, when I'm writing news like that, I don't worry a lot about voice or, you know, being special with my writing. I just really think about how can I be the very clearest about this so that people walk away with the information they need. Misinformation, I think, comes from that same wellspring of clarity. You know, the clearer we are, the simpler we make the messages, the easier it is. One of the reasons misinformation does so well is that it offers these very simple, pat explanations for very complicated questions. And so if you want to combat misinformation, your information has to be somewhere as close to clear. Obviously, it can't be quite as clear because science is complicated, but you try to simplify as much as possible. And at the New York Times, we were actually really fortunate during the pandemic. We have reporters whose job is to combat misinformation, who sort of track social media for things that were coming out that were absolutely wrong. And they would write these articles with, you know, very clear headlines like, no, the Pfizer vaccine does not cause infertility, just really direct and to the point. And I learned a lot from them, too, about how to frame those messages.
You recently reported that experts remain optimistic in spite of an uptick in COVID cases across the nation. And a Wisconsin pediatric infectious disease expert at UW Health told a Milwaukee TV station that they feared the uptick in cases could cause problems for schools. How would you respond to their concern?
I think that's actually correct. I think we are in a much better shape than we were the last 3 years. That's true. But it's also true that it could cause problems. In fact, already in some schools in Texas and Kentucky, they had to shut them down because there were so many kids and staff that were sick. And so I think that's absolutely a possibility. just because people will not get so severely ill that they will die in huge numbers does not mean that it won't be a problem. I mean, we saw with Omicron that even when a variant is mild and just causes people to be sick, but not necessarily severely ill or to die, you know, the country still came to a standstill because there were just so many people who were ill. And so that kind of thing can happen. And as we know, you know, viruses really spread pretty quickly in schools. And so if you have a bunch of kids coming in, bringing the virus in, it could very easily spread through the school community and the school might need to shut down. And so that is a possibility. But also, I think we have to remember the positive side, which is that it's very unlikely that any of those kids or their relatives will get very sick unless we see some new variant come through that's, you know, bringing us some surprises, some mutations that we haven't seen before.
Well, let's turn our attention now to the school building with fall semesters underway at various grade levels. What are important ways of improving and maintaining air quality in schools?
Yeah, I mean, if school districts don't want the schools to shut down because a lot of kids get sick, I think the number one thing they can do is improve the school building's ventilation. I mean, the average school building in this country is very old, and a lot of buildings don't have modern ventilation systems. There are a lot of windows that are painted shut and won't open, even if you want them to open. And, you know, we saw in the Northeast, and I know you saw in Wisconsin, that when you have something like wildfire smoke, you can't just open the window. You really need a good ventilation system to keep the school open and to keep students healthy. So that, I think, is the number one thing that school districts and schools can do to make their students' lives healthier and safer.
Apoorva Mandavilli is a New York Times science and global health reporter, UW-Madison alum, as we explore recent reporting on indoor air quality in schools, takeaways from covering the pandemic. Call in with a question, add your insights along the way, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The pandemic brought attention to proper ventilation in buildings and the air quality in school classrooms. And a recent report by The New York Times finds schools still need to improve in this area. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Apoorva Mandavilli is a New York Times science and global health reporter and UW-Madison alum. Apoorva, there is potential new legislation afoot here in Wisconsin that would call for air quality inspections in Wisconsin schools. Lawmakers saying it would help schools with poor air quality determine next steps. Could legislation requiring statewide school air quality inspections be useful?
I think it would be very useful. One of the reasons that schools haven't really done a lot about this is because there's not a lot of guidance, there's not a lot of information, and there's not a lot of legal pressure. You know, it's really done on a volunteer basis at this point. If a school district decides air quality is important, it can do something. But I think having some legal teeth behind it would be really useful. And knowing exactly how bad air quality is really the first step. You know, you can't really fix a problem unless you know what the problem is. And so I think that legislation really has the power to the potential to change some things. I mean, there is a lot of money available to fix air quality if schools want to do it. You know, the American Rescue Plan Act put aside $200 billion for school districts to improve matters. And Wisconsin got more than $1.5 billion. But, you know, I was looking and Wisconsin has spent about 20% of those funds. So there's definitely plenty of money. And all that's really required is willpower.
Your report, you know, looking at pollution, wildfire smoke contributing to low air quality in schools. And you wrote about how students of color more often attend schools close to highways and factories that spew air pollution. How can schools prevent, you know, marginalized communities from facing this disproportionate level of pollution in their schools?
I think those schools need the most attention. You know, they're also often in the poorest buildings of the poorest quality. They have the fewest staff, they have the fewest resources, and they often have parent bodies that don't have the time or the resources to push for the changes. So the onus really falls on school districts and on state governments and local governments to make sure that those schools have everything that they need. And often the problems are, you know, really basic, like the school principals don't know what's available. They don't know how to apply for it. They don't know, you know, whom to ask for help. I mean, these are all things that are easily solvable. There are, of course, bigger problems that are more difficult to solve, like where the schools are located. But there are things that school districts and leadership can do to improve matters.
Is there a connection between student academic achievement and classroom ventilation?
Absolutely. I mean, we talk about air quality now so much more because of the pandemic. But first of all, there were schools shutting down because of flu long before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And there are other respiratory infections that we know come through schools, right? I have kids. I definitely have lived through many years of being mm-hmm. sick, it seemed like every other minute. And it also can affect scores, as you said, academic performance, memory, concentration, and health. I mean, we know that air pollution can really affect health in a bad way, and it can actually lead to shorter lifespan. You know, we know this from data from other countries, but it's also increasingly true here that we have a severe problem with air pollution, as we all saw this summer.
As we all saw this summer, I mean, in, you know, during the early stages of the pandemic, some schools took their classrooms outside, but that might not be an option. How have outdoor classrooms held up?
Outdoor classrooms have done very well where they're possible, you know, and some schools have kept up their outdoor classrooms, especially for, say, kindergarten classes that can be done outside relatively easily, where kids can play and explore nature. You know, it might seem like that's an impossibility in a place like Wisconsin. I definitely lived through those Madison winters, but there are, you know, countries like Finland that have had outdoor classrooms and had them year round. So it's not entirely out of the question, but, you know, it is limited in what schools can do. And so I think wildfire will make that impossible. Air pollution will make that impossible. Definitely certain kinds of weather will make it difficult, if not impossible. And so it's really a Band-Aid fix, ultimately, and we need to have indoor air quality that's good enough that students can be inside all day and we don't have to worry about their health.
Apoorva, I'm in a studio here, and I'm looking across. There is a portable air filter in the room I'm in. Have those caught on in classrooms or in school budgets?
They have, you know, but it's very patchy. I mean, there are some school districts where schools have bought filters, and those can be very helpful. I mean, you have to know how big the air filter should be for the size of the room that you have. And that's where, you know, the legislation that you mentioned, that kind of thing can be really useful. Even if you already have an air filter, is the air quality in that room really good? But if you have enough air filters, there is data showing that they can filter out most particle pollutants, and they can improve air quality. They can filter out pathogens. So those can be useful. They're not all that expensive. There are also some sort of MacGyver devices, one called the Corsi Rosenthal box that costs very little money because all you need is a box fan and some duct tape. And there are online tutorials on how to do that. And some schools did that because they didn't have money to buy air filters. So there are low-cost options, but I really have to keep going back to the point that these are all temporary interim fixes. We really should be thinking about overhauling air quality indoors on a much larger, more ambitious scale.
Apoorva Mondavilli is a New York Times science and global health reporter. As we look at air quality in schools and get your reaction, your thoughts, call in with a question at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Apoorva, you quote, like, just a really staggering amount of money that's being left on the table and, you know, that could be used to improve air quality infrastructure in schools. But for schools that are using the federal dollars, how are they changing their air quality? What are they using the money on?
They're using it to improve their ventilation system. So put in modern ventilation systems that have the highest quality filters. There is an organization called ASHRAE that does not have legal authority, but does set guidelines and best practices for buildings. And so schools have been looking at those to see what they need to do to improve their HVAC systems, as we call them, heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems. For some schools, that's not an option because they're just so old that they can't actually have modern systems. And so they are looking for sort of other solutions that they can do to improve air conditioning and setting up really good quality filters, air filters, for example, things like that. But you can't fully blame schools that aren't doing a lot either because they have a lot on their plate. I looked through a ton of Wisconsin school plans or how they're spending ESSER funds, which is the funds from the American Rescue Plan Act. And a lot of them don't even list air quality or ventilation, but their plans are full of things like teacher shortages and digital equipment to help with learning loss and all kinds of things that really became important during the pandemic. But hopefully, as those things ease up a little bit, they can turn their attention to air quality and make some of these changes.
Right. I mean, we think about ensuring there's a licensed teacher. We think about busing. We think about meals. But do we think enough about the role of a building and how it can connect to a kid's success?
We don't, and it's interesting, right? Because we spend 90% of our time indoors, and we worry about the quality of the water we drink, the quality of the food we eat, the quality of the medicines we take. But we really have not spent a lot of time in this country thinking or talking about the quality of the air we breathe. The EPA worries about outdoor air, but really, there's no agency, no law that is having, that forces buildings and schools and businesses and everyone to think about the quality of the air that we're breathing indoors all day long.
How can people find out how their local schools are spending government funds in our last moments together here?
There is a website that they can go to look up what their particular state is doing. It's the U.S. Department of Education website that lists all of the states, what percent of ESSER funds, the funds that they've received, they've spent so far. And you can even drill down and look at your individual school district. That's not true for all states, but it's true for Wisconsin. They can look at their individual school district's plan for how they're going to spend the money. And they can maybe push their school districts to spend some more and to have clearer plans for air quality.
Apoorva, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Apoorva Mondavilli, New York Times science and global health reporter, UW-Madison alum. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.